Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald and Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the DC metropolitan area and across the country for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our firm's lawyers and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today's topic is blowing the whistle in the wake of COVID-19. And talking to us about this timely issue are two of JGL's litigators, Veronica Nanis and Sarah Chu. Veronica is a partner at Joseph Greenwald and Lake and serves as the chair of the Civil Litigation Department. She litigates key TAM cases and consumer class actions, typically involving kickbacks and other fraud. In the last 2 years, her cases have returned over $40 million to the government and taxpayers through False Claims Act cases. Sarah is an associate at Joseph Greenwald and Lake. She works in the key TAM practice, representing whistleblowers nationwide in sealed investigations and unsealed litigation under the Federal and State False Claims Acts. Sarah joined JGL in 2016 while she pursued her JD at the University of Maryland School of Law and worked almost exclusively on key TAM matters since. She continues to represent whistleblowers in cases that involve various types of fraud, including healthcare fraud and government procurement fraud perpetrated by various actors. Welcome to both of you. They're very long words in our introduction, so I hope that you can explain a lot of that to folks out there. Thanks for joining us, Veronica and Sarah.
Thank you so much for having us, David.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Sarah, we were together, I guess, a month or two ago, and you talked a lot about the False Claims Act. So before we dig deeper with you and Veronica, let's just do a recap, right? What is this key TAM? It sounds like soup, or, you know, what does that mean?
Yeah, we talked about this last time too, David.
And I forgot, so I'm certain other people may have too.
You know, do we pronounce it as key TAM or key TAM or key TAM? Everyone has different, you know, different definitions of what key TAM is. But you're right, I did provide an overview of the False Claims Act last time. False Claims Act is, you know, we've got these whistleblowers that can file a case under seal on behalf of the government. So private relators can bring a False Claims Act case on behalf of the government. And that's sort of what the statute entails. And the statute is designed to combat all sorts of different fraud that's committed against the government. And we did go into detail a little bit last time about, you know, in the healthcare regime, the government contracting regime, and things like that. And I think in this particular episode, we really wanted to focus on a narrow and timely issue, which is a potential government fraud stemming from COVID-19 relief funds. And so that's where we are today.
Awesome. Now, Veronica, let me ask you as we get started, just so we can start from the baseline for folks. We all hear this term whistleblower. What does that mean exactly?
It can mean different things in different scenarios. But what we're talking about here are ordinary citizens, employees or contractors who have insider information about government fraud. And so Sarah and I represent whistleblowers all around the country under the False Claims Act. And it's really unique because ordinary citizens can who have insider knowledge of fraud can actually file suit on behalf of the government. Right? That's really odd. Usually the government can only file suit on behalf of itself, and it can in False Claims Acts, but also a whistleblower who has knowledge about fraud, you know, the government is being defrauded of money somehow, then they can file suit on behalf of the government to help the government recoup that money. And that's where Sarah and I come in. And we file these suits all around the country representing whistleblowers who can be anyone who has insider knowledge, you know. So we tend to represent a lot of healthcare workers, but it also can be contractors, it can be sales folks, it can be compliance people. It runs the gamut, really anyone who's got knowledge of that fraud and can bring us really good information that the government might be interested in, then Sarah and I are interested too.
So most of us who've been following, obviously, what the feds have been doing, what Congress has been doing over the last several months are aware of the billions of dollars that have been given out both to individuals and businesses and the private sector and so forth. And also those of us who are a little jaded know where money is being given out, money is being stolen. So tell us a little bit, do you think that this, the COVID relief package or packages, soon to be packages, is an area that you may see some fraud?
There's no question. We're already seeing it. So this act goes all the way back to the Civil War, and it was enacted because they were defrauding the government regarding selling some military equipment back in the Civil War, right? Back in the 1800s. And it's been going ever since. And so it's only limited by the imagination, you know, I think. So absolutely, you hit the nail on the head. Whenever there's money being given out by the government, there are people scheming about ways to get that money that they're not entitled to.
Interesting. So tell us a little bit then, and throw it out to both of you. What types of fraud related to COVID-19 do you think will qualify under the False Claims Act?
I'll be the first one. So when the pandemic first hit us, you know, earlier in 2020, there was a sudden need for a lot of things, right? And that included a mass quantity of personal protective equipment, which I will refer to as PPE. And there was this high demand for masks, gloves, you know, other PPEs, and they had to be produced in a very short amount of time because we've never dealt with COVID before, right? I always say that the COVID fraud is this new strain of fraud, and only certain types of fraud can make a government whistleblower case under the FCA, and COVID-19 fraud happens to be one of them. And so the government at this time, specifically for PPEs, and so I'll sort of get into that, but the government was looking for vendors and supply companies who wanted to produce PPEs and secure contracts with the federal government during that surge. And so I kind of saw it as the government was in a scramble to look for, you know, vendors and supply companies, but also supply companies were scrambling to secure that contract. They didn't want to, you know, they didn't want to miss the surge. And so while there was a lot of good that came out of that because we actually needed the PPEs, there was this concern for potential fraud against the government. And like, you know, Veronica and David, you both said, when a lot of money is being thrown out, there's always that concern for potential fraud, especially against the government. So I'm sure you're thinking, you know, what kind of fraud? What does that look like? What does that mean for our whistleblowers, our potential clients who do come to us and say, well, what am I, you know, what should I be looking for? And so, one of the examples that I came across was, let's say you work for a medical supply company that produces PPEs, right? And then during the process of securing that federal contract with the government, perhaps your supervisor instructs you to make some sort of misrepresentation or false certification within the contract applications that directly submitted to the government. And so, for example, they could misrepresent the effectiveness or the quality of their PPEs, right? Because the government is not going to, there was no time to vet or test these supply companies in, you know, a very, in a manner where there's the course of process where they're supposed to go through to test these supply companies. And so keep in mind that the government really relies on accurate certifications and accurate representations of what these supply companies were supposed to offer to the government contracts. And so if they knew that a company was falsely representing certain qualifications about a certain PPE, that could result in patient harm, really, right? They would not have awarded these contracts. And those are some of the things, those are the broad schemes that you should probably be looking for. If you are, let's say you're working for a medical supply company and your supervisor instructs you to say, you know, just say that we can provide, you know, 1 million masks when you know for sure that you can only produce 100,000 or none at all. That's the type of fraud that we should be looking for. False certifications and misrepresentations are really key because they can fraudulently secure these massive government contracts that wouldn't have been awarded to the supply company had they known. And so, in interest of time, I'll sort of stop there. But those are some of the red flags that potential whistleblowers in that industry should be looking for if they were looking to file an FCA case on behalf of the government.
You know what it reminds me of too? At the time, everybody, you take yourself back a few months to March and April when we were all scrambling to figure out, you know, do I need PPE? Do I need an N95 mask? Does my family, does my, you know, elderly grandparents? And we were all kind of looking online and trying to figure that out. I'm sure people heard on the news and read about scams that were being done on the public, right? On the ordinary public. Oh, I have a vaccine, or I have this rapid test. I'm going door to door and selling this, or I can provide you with N95 masks. I'm sure we all got fake emails or very suspicious emails about that. And so all of that was sort of fraud on the public, right? They were trying to scam each and every one of us as ordinary citizens. That kind of same fraud was happening on the government. you know, is what Sarah's talking about. And that's when we get into the realm of the False Claims Act on a much larger scale, but that was kind of happening to the government too.
So it reminds me a little bit of like, you know, those elevator cases that you read about, or maybe automobile cases where there's a part that can be installed to increase the safety of whether it's an automobile or elevator or whatever. Is it the same kind of thing where these companies, the motivation is I can produce something that's maybe substandard, might not be the right word, but you know what I'm getting at, below what it ought to be or what the requirements are, because it's saving me 2 cents or a nickel or whatever it may be per unit. And therefore, you know, if I'm sending out millions and millions of these PPE pieces, whatever they may be, masks or gowns or whatever, the savings are astronomical, and their profits are astronomical to that company that's looking to, in that sense, defraud the government. Is that right, or am I missing something?
No, I think that's a really good analogy. That actually happens in a lot of my government contracting cases right now. That's not in the PPE regime. A lot of these contracting companies, they have to fulfill certain requirements and certain certifications in order to be awarded that certain type of contract. But they may be cutting corners here and there just to make profit. You know, they might be getting a cheaper material, or the defective medical device might not be a big deal to them, but it is a big deal. It can snowball into patient harm and provider harm. And so you're right. There are definitely situations where they think that this is okay, and they cut corners here and there just to make profit. But it involves when it involves government funding, I mean, it becomes a bigger issue under the False Claims Act.
And what about the involvement of potential kickbacks in this type of scenario? Do you see that at all? Do you expect to see that?
I think I will expect to see that a lot. You know, Veronica and I work with a lot of kickback scheme cases, and those are one of my personal favorites because it's just, I don't want to say easier to prove, but the government often, you know, it is sort of, it's a straightforward fraud, right? If we have referrals, if we have the person soliciting or paying kickbacks, the kickback violation is pretty clear cut. And so while I haven't seen a lot of settlements yet, I assume that a lot are under seal at this time because, you know, they probably were filed earlier in 2020. But, you know, I'm anticipating a situation where a provider, you know, maybe you're a nurse or a therapist working for a medical facility, and you see that your provider is receiving kickbacks from some sort of other incentive from a lab facility that sells COVID testing kits, right? And so maybe those sales reps are coming to you and talked about lavish wine and dining last time.
Not so much of that now.
Yeah, that's true. They're going to have to think of other incentives. And they come to you with these, you know, COVID testing kits, and in exchange, your employer sends referrals to these labs. I mean, that's kickback, right? And that triggers a number of violations under the applicable kickback rules and regulations. But, you know, it's the key thing to note is that all claims submitted under that improper arrangement between the provider and the lab, these are false claims under the FCA. So just because, you know, the kickbacks relate to the false claims under the FCA. So these are the type of improper dealings, improper arrangements that I'm expecting to see within that regime.
What I think would raise a flag, right, would be, is there something of value that's being exchanged for a referral? So anything of value. You know, we think about money, right? Brown bags, and it sounds all like some sort of a movie, and there's a cash, you know, brown bag filled with cash. That could be it. That is it in a lot of these cases. But sometimes it's different, right? Sometimes it's, you know, lavish dinners and golf trips. Sometimes it's, I'm going to pay for your advertising. We had that case. It's really anything of value that's getting you to refer patients, refer those Medicare, Medicaid patients to me or whatever that is. So really, it's kind of like, you know, our firm's based in Maryland, and we've got a lot of government contracting around us, and we've heard a lot about, you know, real estate and government pay to play. It's a similar scenario that Sarah and I are talking about, you know, but in the healthcare field, where we're talking about these kickbacks. You know, if I pay you, you send me your patients, right? That's kind of the base dynamic that people would look out for, and that should raise some flags.
So Veronica, if someone is out there and observing the kind of fraud that you're describing, that you two have described on the government, you know, what do they do in that circumstance? What should they do?
They really need to contact a lawyer who practices in this area right away. And there's at least three major reasons for that, right? So one, is that there is potential exposure for that person. You know, if they are participating in the fraud themselves and they have, they're a doctor, they're a nurse, they have a license, they're a government contractor, they may potentially have some civil exposure. They don't want to be caught up in the government finding out about this. So that's kind of number one. You know, we want to find out, do you have any liability? What should you be doing? Do you need to quit? Do you need to leave? Do you need to report? What should you be doing? Number two, there are issues about whether to take documents and how to take documents and what sort of evidence Sarah and I would really want and the government would need to make a case like this, but that's a minefield. And you definitely want to contact an attorney ahead of time so they can walk you through what's proper, what's legal, and how to do that the right way. And then these cases, you know, there are a lot of defenses to these cases and a lot of procedural hurdles. You got to file quick, you got to be the first one, but it has to be detailed enough. And so, you know, basically the sooner you contact somebody who can help you work your way through the minefield of issues, the better off you're going to be. And then you can make an educated decision. Do I have a case? Should I be a whistleblower? What does that look like? But you know, the sooner you contact somebody, then they can actually walk you through all of those issues.
I want to get to that also, but let me touch back on something you just mentioned. So there, which struck me, and that is that there may be someone out there, right, who thinks that they see something, some fraud being perpetrated on the government, but unwittingly, they're participating in it, right?
Yeah, or maybe they do know, you know, but they're being told to do it, or they at least suspect that they're being told to do it. They're being told it's okay. Sometimes they're being told by compliance officers and general counsel. Sometimes they're being told by, you know, people they trust, and they have no reason to really question other than that something's nagging at them that it doesn't feel right. I have to say that that never disqualifies anyone from being a whistleblower. We always want to hear from those folks. They're usually the ones with the best intelligence, right? They know what's going on because they're working in it. So the government is fine with that too. Really, that, you know, when the government does go after individuals, we're talking about the individuals at the highest part of the pyramid who are the ones who devised this scheme. You know, they're the ones running it all. It's never going after, you know, folks, you know, physicians, even physicians who may be in receipt of kickbacks. I've had tons of cases like that, and they don't go after the physicians. They're really kind of going after the mastermind of the plan. But, you know, we always say that, you know, I expect a lot of our whistleblowers to have gone along with this to some degree as they're sort of working through it and figuring it out and maybe having their suspicions before they reach out to an attorney. So that definitely doesn't disqualify them. It usually gives us more information. That's really critical.
I just wanted to add, I mean, and in fact, their very participation is sort of what drives them to file these kind of cases and come to us, because they understand what's going on. And, you know, they have to endure a lot because they know this is wrong at some point, and they report it up the chain. But when they get shut down, they realize, what other options do I have? And so this sort of prompts them to file a case or reach out to a whistleblower lawyer sooner rather than later. And, you know, they're at a juncture where their information may be the timeliest to pursue a case. And I think they're kind of at the best position to file a case or to pursue legal options because they're participating in it constantly.
Okay, so now let's go to the next step, right? We've got this person who's contacted your office, who's scheduled an appointment to meet with the two of you or one or both of you. And what is it that you look for in evaluating the strength of a case, the merits of the case? I mean, I'm assuming these cases take a lot of time and a lot of effort, and you folks have to analyze whether it's worth your time and effort. So I want to ask you both, what do you look for in a case to see if it's a good, solid one? And also, what do you look for that may send your red flags up that say, maybe this isn't something for me?
Veronica and I really, you know, I can say that we assess each case really, really thoroughly before we make a decision to take the case, right? And I think as a starting point, a client's testimony is really valuable for building that credibility to the case. But sometimes it may not be enough in certain situations. So common types of evidence that I like to see when clients come to me is really documentary evidence, right? Incriminating emails or text messages, contemporary notes, billing records, patient files, anything that's really substantive. I mean, I'm always asking Veronica, do they have more? Do they have more that will sort of corroborate the client's story? And so it's important to be prompt about this, right? Because oftentimes our clients may be on the way out from their job or in the process of resigning because they hate dealing with the fraud, so they may lose access to it. So I really, really focus on what they have and what they have access to at this moment in time before it gets out of hand and before we don't have access to it anymore. On the other hand, when there isn't much documentary evidence to provide, Veronica and I vet the client and we see whether they may have enough knowledge in their position about the defendant company to help me develop some sort of discovery plan to steer the government in a direction where they could find the documentary evidence that the client may not initially provide. And so it proved to be helpful in some of my government contracting cases involving kickbacks. And actually what proved to be really helpful for me in some of my contracting cases involving kickbacks, rarely will we find a smoking gun email that states, I'm going to pay you a kickback now. Kickback, pay me, you know, give me whatever, right? You're not going to find a smoking gun email like that. And it really astonishes me when sometimes the government asks for those type of emails and they must know that that's not, but we can infer that if my whistleblower client tells me, you know, there is a file living in, you know, somewhere in the world of the ether titled invoices to sales rep, for example, and in the F drive that's only accessible by the CFO and VP, and you need a password to access that. That's so key, right? Because while there won't be a smoking gun email about kickbacks, but we can find and infer pieces together from that type of information. And so, I guess, long story short, I really focus on documentary evidence, but even if you don't have those, if you have the information to help me form a discovery plan for the government to look for the things, that's really key for me too.
So Veronica, let's flip to the other side. What are the red flags when you're meeting with someone for the first time that give you pause in taking a case like this?
These cases take a long time for us and for the government. And there are so many cases like this because the fraud is so big and so broad, the government can't get to it all. And our goal is to get the government interested and get them to try to settle the case. And so that there's a recovery for them and a recovery for our client. So when folks come to us and they say, you know, I've been working at, you know, this particular employer for 5 years and there's really fishy stuff going on. And they have what I'll describe as kind of like just a little bit of like water cooler talk and gossip to tell me. Even though it might, you know, seem a little bit dramatic, if there's no substance under there at all, you know, and they really can't connect the dots like Sarah's talking about too, I say, well, you know, who did that and when did that happen and how much fraud and what did the government pay? You know, if they can't answer a lot of my follow-up questions just on a basic level, then I think, you know, they might be right. There might be something fishy going on, but it's certainly not enough for me to go to the, you know, for me to present it to the government. You know, Sarah and I are talking about our complaints are 100 pages long, filled with detail, because that's what's required of these cases. And I can't fill that detail in with just a couple of suspicions here or there, or, you know, oh, I heard something about this, you know, would you be interested? It's not really that our clients are tipsters in that way. You know, they're not just giving a little tip. They're really supposed to have developed kind of a plan for us, a scheme. What is it? What's happening? And can you connect the dots between what your company is doing and what the government's paying that they shouldn't be paying? And so, you know, when Sarah and I kind of hear those, we might say, you know what, I hear you, might be right, but that doesn't sound like something that we would want to spend a lot of our time on. And we don't think that the government would be interested in spending years and its resources, you know, running down some of your suspicions.
Now, are these people that come to you and ultimately you take the case and report a fraud being perpetrated on the government, are they protected if it's a COVID-19 related matter?
Well, they're protected no matter what. If they become a whistleblower, there are very strong retaliation provisions that, you know, I don't know, Sarah, if you want to take that one, but it's not just related to COVID-19. It's anybody who files under the False Claims Act is protected.
They worry about being fired, right? Or something along. That's the worst thing, it seems to me. They get fired or whatever else can happen to an employee, I guess, in his or her industry. Isn't that a concern of folks that come to you? Whether, I guess, like you said, Veronica, whether it's COVID-19 related or something else.
We have current employees that do come to us with this concern that they're being retaliated in the workplace, right? And they could be facing potential termination or discrimination in the workplace because they may have reported certain types of fraud internally. And so they come to us with that. And, you know, immediately Veronica and I are like, okay, but that's also an FCA piece here. And so we kind of delve into more of that after they come to us with these. But I mean, like Veronica said, there are federal and state whistleblower laws with anti-retaliation provisions and they're implemented to prevent any of this, you know, retaliatory conduct or discrimination as a result of their direct internal reporting of the fraud. And so for current employers, I would say these provisions do provide an adequate layer of protection from termination or discrimination in the workplace. You know, I would also keep in mind that these FCA cases, for the ones that have already left the workplace, these cases are filed under seal, right? So the process provides, I guess, a certain degree of anonymity for a period of time while the case is undergoing investigation. So there's that too. I mean, Veronica and I can tell you that we've had plenty of people who are still working at the medical facility, even though the settlement was being pursued. And we've advised that you should probably leave because you're probably concerned with X, Y, and Z factors. But she's still, you know, I mean, it's a whole host of issues that could, factors that could define the decisions of these current employers deciding to stay at the employer, current employees deciding to stay at the employer. So, but I would say overall, we have good anti-retaliation provisions that do provide an adequate layer of protection.
So someone who's been litigating cases, different types of cases for 30 plus years, I don't even want to count the number of years. I tell clients often as we embark on litigation in my area, you know, that my favorite line is that the wheels of justice turn slowly, right? And in COVID, as we all know, with the shutdowns and so forth, those wheels sometimes have fallen off completely, or in some cases, you know, come to a I don't want to say a halt, but certainly a grinding slowdown. So for someone who's thinking of coming and speaking to you and talking about the possibility of bringing a whistleblower action, does it make any sense to even do that during COVID, or should they, you know, just sort of sit on things and wait till we're all back at movie theaters and baseball games?
No, don't wait. So in addition to, you know, what I told you earlier about all the reasons to get to a lawyer really fast and really quick, one of the reasons is because there is a defense in the False Claims Act. If you're not first to file, even if you have the best evidence and you're the one that helps the government, but if you're the second person to file that claim, or the third or the fourth or the fifth, you're not entitled to anything. You know, so the government can settle a $100 million case based on your evidence. And if you weren't first, you're not entitled to any of that. The first person is, even if they had hardly nothing, you know, hardly no evidence for the government. So there's actually pretty harsh, you know, issues there in terms of a defense. So there's reason more to do it. And Sarah and I are seeing, by the way, also, you know, the government, it's still going, you know, there's still settlements. There was just one regarding the first one under COVID, I think. Settlement in January regarding PPP loan fraud. And, you know, so the government is still going after these and they're still settling them. And so there's every reason to get, you know, to talk to an attorney now. And if you have a good case, to file it and get it in the pipeline. The government is really actively looking at investigating these cases.
So no reason to wait. Pick up the phone, give you a call.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us today. It's been really an awesome conversation. We probably could talk about it for hours, and you're so far above my head, it would be lots and lots of hours. But let me ask you both, for those folks who are out there listening, what's the best way, Veronica, you first, and Sarah, for people to get a hold of you if they think they've got something that they want to discuss in terms of some fraud pursuant to the Act?
Yes, you can go to our website, jgllaw.com, and find both of our bios there. My email is thenannis@jgllaw.com, and I'm also pretty active on LinkedIn. You can find me there.
Great. And that's VNANNIS, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Sarah?
And I'll add to that, my email is schu@jgllaw.com, and I obviously work very closely with Veronica. So if you reach her, then you can reach me too, and vice versa. So any whistleblower fraud that's happening out there, you know, there's been a lot of buzz around COVID fraud lately, and we'd love to hear it if it's out there.
Terrific. Thank you guys so much. Everyone out there, thanks for joining us. People are listening regularly every week now. Keep it up. We'll be back shortly with our next episode. I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.